with the practices there. Right now, he is a private consultant in sustainable forestry, and he serves as Museum Research Associate in Zoology at the University of Washington in Seattle. He is the author of a great many scientific articles and another book, which is about the future of forestry. It's entitled The Redesigned Forest. The book that we'll be talking about some this morning is entitled Forest Primeval, The Natural History of an Ancient Forest. It is published by Sierra Club Books, and it charts the history of this forest from its germination to close to the present day, at least the time when our guest came in contact with it. And it presents side by side a history of this forest with what is going on in the rest of the world. And what it does, I think, is really reinforce just how old and stately and majestic this kind of forest is. As we talk with Chris Mazur, you are certainly invited to call in and talk with us. You have questions or comments. The telephone number here is 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line, and that one's good anywhere that you can hear us. And that number is 800-222-9455. So again, it's 333-WILL and 800-222-WILL. Mr. Mazur, hello.
Hi.
Thanks very much for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I'm interested in just to start, maybe having you expand a little bit or talk a little bit more about something that you have written here in the introduction to your book. In the very beginning here, you write that writing this book has forever changed my sense of the forest, my sense of humanity, my sense of history, my sense of the humanity of history, and my sense of the history of humanity. In what ways did writing this book cause you to start to think differently about forest? Certainly that's something that you, prior to this, had known a lot about and had a lot of experience with.
Well, the thing that was interesting was my experience with the forest was only within my lifetime, which is a very, very infinitesimal piece of history. And in writing something that goes back 1,000 years in carrying the human struggle for consciousness forward and dealing with the human suffering over 1,000 years gave me a real sense of just how old a 1,000-year-old tree is in terms of the human experience. The other thing is that in giving me a sense of history, the 1,000-year-old tree is a living continuity within that sense of history. And history tends to be somewhat disjunct when you just get it out of history books. It's something which happened in the past. But here is a living thing that could actually witness 1,000 years of history. And that puts it in a whole different dynamic. Finally, the history of humanity, again, embodied in the life of a single tree, I didn't really have a context for how much human suffering and struggle and striving for consciousness really took place in a 1,000-year span, and it's been incredible. Yeah. And then looking at it on the flip side, looking at the humanity of history and the history of humanity, I began to realize just how much human suffering has been caused by human beings beating each other up. Mm. That was nothing I had ever really put together. I see the things that are going on today, but I realized that they're no different today than they were 1,000 years ago. The only thing that's different is we have created far more sophisticated ways of killing each other.
You know, one of the things that I think the book really does is to impress on one the true age of these forests. And it's easy to talk about old growth forest and the fact that yes, certainly they've been there a long time. But when you set the sort of the history of these areas alongside the history of civilization, at least it struck me in a way that I hadn't thought about it before, just what it is we're talking about. One, you mentioned here that in fact that there is apparently a tree in the Sequoia National Park, mm-hmm. that in 1968, so some years ago, at that time, was estimated to be 3,800 years old, right. 3,800 years old, and that it would have had to germinate in 1832 B.C.
Right. Right.
And that pretty much stopped me in my tracks. That you know, you can talk about, yeah, these forests are old and they're old growth forests, but when you sit there and think this tree germinated 1832 BC, it impressed me very much. And I suppose all the trees aren't that old. I guess there are some trees that are even older than that, though.
The bristlecone pine, some have been estimated to be 4,000 years. We get mixed up, though, in looking at forests and trees and thinking the big trees are necessarily the oldest trees.
Mm-hmm.
Bristlecone pine is a little gnarled, scrawny thing growing on mountaintops, which have been secluded from fire, or it probably wouldn't have gotten so old. So age is not necessarily correlated with size, and this is one of the things that I find really interesting when dealing with the public.
Uh-huh.
Last summer, I took a group out to Mount Rainier National Park, and we looked at the big trees down below, which were maybe 400 years old, some of them, and then I took them up to subalpine and said, welcome to the ancient forest, and we're looking at stunted things that were over 600 years old, and they said, what are you talking about? Well, the trees at timberline were actually older, smaller, scrawny, piddly little things, but they were far older than the big towering giants down below.
Hmm.
And that has to do with growing site and how they grow. It's no different than somebody who's malnourished standing next to somebody who's well-nourished. The one can be big and massive and the other small, and they can be the same age.
When you look at this kind of forest, what are the identifying characteristics? What is it that sets this place apart from any place else?
Well, an old-growth forest, let's say in the Douglas fir region, Douglas fir hemlock, takes on the old-growth characteristics between 200 and 250 years of age. And it's things like the crowns, the top of the tree, the living portion, the green portion, looks like a broken bottle brush. They become very individualistic. And because of the way they've grown, the branches tend to be heavier on one side than the other as trees begin to die out of the system and the light comes on and branches grow more on one side. So they begin to lean. And the other thing that happens is the bark has now become very thick and protects them from fire at the ground level. The limbs often don't start till they're 60 feet above the ground. And what we call the epiphytic community, the community of plants that live up in the treetops, like some of the lichens, which are really two plants in one. A lichen is an outside of fungus, and an inside it houses algae. The algae produce the food from photosynthesis that the fungus can't, and the fungus houses the algae. These types of things begin to develop in the top of the tree when they're about 200, 250 years old. The other thing is the trees begin to die singly now. Up until that time, till about 120 years to 150 years, suppression kills the trees. In other words, the trees are competing with each other for light, and the weaker ones die out. But as the canopy, as the forest gradually opens up as it gets older, it's now single trees that die. And the thing that's interesting about tree death is, theoretically, and underlying theoretically, trees are immortal. Unlike human beings that cannot replace heart, liver, brain, because those organs do not renew themselves, a tree renews its entire living tissue every year, and so it replaces its whole immune system. What kills trees is the harshness of their environment, disease, injury. And as these trees are injured, let's say one big tree falls, and it brushes against another one, and it goes through the bark and bears the wood. It scrapes down the wood on the side of the tree, and it leaves maybe 10 feet long by 6 inches wide. It leaves us a wound. Well, that wound is a place for beetles to attack, for fungal spores to land, and they can start invading the wood. And then it can heal over. And 100 years later, the tree dies. Well, the tree has been dying gradually for 100 years, but the thing is you don't see it. And so the trees gradually go out of the stand one by one, and the stand opens up. And there are a lot of declining trees dying gradually in the stand. And all of this is part of the physiological age or old growthedness of the forest.
Mm-hmm. There's also must be something something special about this part of the United States or this part of the world that means that we have these forests where they are. I gather that around the United States there are other places where there are quite old trees, or there have been and they may have been lost. But again, maybe it's climate, maybe it's geology that somehow makes this such a great place to grow these kind of trees.
Well, all of what you've said is basically true. If we go back 1.5 million years in the Northwest, Pacific Northwest, Douglas fir, for example, was just one of the trees that was in the higher elevation. 1.5 million years ago, it was the same forest out here at the low elevation that is now on the East Coast. It was the eastern deciduous forest. But as the Ice Age began to come on, as the Pleistocene began to move forward, the cold adapted trees, the conifers, the Douglas fir, the larches, the hemlocks, they began to come lower down because they were better adapted. And the eastern deciduous forest of the hickory, the elm, the chestnut, etc., died out and was forced eastward. Then as the Ice Age continued, the spruce, which now is only found in the northern part of Canada in the boreal forest, white and black spruce, it came down and invaded through what is today the Great Plains. And until 12,500 years ago, that black and white spruce was in Texas. So the eastern deciduous forest was pushed eastward. As the boreal forest came down, actually, it wasn't so much pushed eastward, it just died out. The conifers, which include the spruce, which were more adapted to the cold, took over. Then an interesting thing happened about 10,000 years ago when the Pleistocene closed and the modern age came on and the land started to warm up again. And keep in mind that the difference between the Ice Age and what we have today is only 3 degrees centigrade. It's a very, very small incremental change in average annual temperature. Well, what happened at that time was that as land dried out, fires became more important again. Now, the conifers had claimed the Northwest pretty much, and Douglas fir, for the first time, became dominant. So Douglas fir has only been dominant in the forest for about 10,000 years since the close of the last Ice Age. As the Ice Age closed and the warming trend started, the spruce moved northward again, and the eastern deciduous forest and juniper sort of covered what is now the Great Plains until fire came in. And fires would sweep through and push the deciduous forest eastward and allow the grasslands to form and form the Great Plains. And that's maintained by fire. Since humans have been suppressing fire, there have been problems with trees, the eastern forest, again, encroaching in the Great Plains, and now they're having to manually control the forest. Out here, we have the richest conifer forest in the world. There are 25 species of coniferous trees, 7 major ones. They live longer and grow larger than any place else in the world. And it's the climate and the geology, and that they were isolated here during the Ice Age, and this is their most favorable habitat.
Well, our guest this morning is Chris Mazur. He was a research scientist with the U.S. Department of the Interior and currently is a private consultant in sustainable forestry. He's a museum research associate in zoology at the University of Washington at Seattle. He's also an author who's written a number of scientific articles, most of them that have to do with forests, including his recent book, The Redesigned Forest. And we're talking about another book that he's written entitled Forest Primeval, The Natural History of an Ancient Forest. And we'd be happy to have any comments or questions that you would have. You just pick up the telephone, give us a call, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. What was it that brought you and the Department of the Interior to a parting of the ways?
Well, a couple of things. The first was, excuse me, I had a wonderful experience with them. There's no bitterness on my part, but what happens in research often is it has an influence on policy. And the policy in this case was the allowable cut. Some of the research that we have been doing over the last 10 years was beginning to show that the cut was not sustainable. And this is an interesting thing in our law. The law is the Multiple Use Sustained Yield Act, but sustained, ED, is past tense. And the only way you can have a sustained yield is to have a sustained cut. And when you run out of cut, you run out of yield. Mm-hmm. And what I began to understand was that we needed to change one word in the law. Rather than sustained yield, it needed to be sustainable yield, which means present, projected into the future. Well, that wasn't the case. And the more I was pointing this out, and the more our data showed that what we're doing was not sustainable, the more the forestry program, the folks that were running the forestry program in the Bureau of Land Management became concerned and told me that I was having an impact on policy. And I said, well, it isn't me. There have been probably 10 of us working on this. And I was hired as a scientist. And I was hired to find the truth, the facts, as the best we understand them. If that has an impact on policy, that's your problem, not mine. And what happened finally was that it was strongly suggested by the Washington office that I be censored. Everything I say and write be censored by a committee before I was allowed to speak. And I would not put up with that because I have to live with me. Mm-hmm. No one else does. And if I give up my integrity, professional or personal, I have nothing of value to offer anybody, including myself. So I had to draw the line.
Yeah. What is the rate of loss today of forest in the United States? Is that a figure that you sort of have in your head?
No, but I could tell you it's astronomical, because whenever we cut a forest, we replant trees, but we do not reforest. No one has ever reforested an acre. We don't even know what a forest is. We don't know what all the pieces are. The entire NASA space program has fewer moving pieces than 1 acre of ground. And putting a person on the moon is simple. It's black and white. It's hit or miss. It's a soft landing or a squish. But managing an acre of ground is all gray, and we don't know the outcome.
Mm. This is something that I think it's good for people to understand because they may not, you know, really understand the difference between trying to recreate a forest that has been cut and the kind of replanting that, you know, that a timber company or a paper company or whatever would say that they that they are doing, and it would give you the impression that what they are trying to do is recreate what was there before. And I guess the fact is that you just can't do it, or maybe you can't do it very quickly.
Well, they're not even trying. What they're doing is converting forests to plantations. They're making glorified Christmas tree farms, which are designed around an economic base to turn a profit. And to do that, they're simplifying. What they're really doing is trading forests in on cornfields that grow trees instead of corn. They're very simple. They have lost most of their biological diversity. They have no concept of the cumulative effects. Cumulative effects, the easiest way I can define that for somebody who isn't familiar with it is to consider that when I was younger, I tried for a while to find the line of sobriety by taking a shot glass and sipping fine vintage wine over an evening. And I was absolutely convinced in my mind that I would know when to stop before I became inebriated. Well, I always learned, but only after I crossed the line, and then it's too late. This is cumulative effect. You see, each glass accumulated the alcohol until it reached a point of no return. That's what we're doing when we manage the land the way we're doing it. And economically, we have cut down the forest, gotten rid of at least half of its biological, physical, functional diversity. We're planting trees in rows, and we're making one assumption that's a carryover from a German economist who came up with what's called the rotation concept, which is the length of time trees need to grow before they can be cut. And that is very simple. We assume that sunlight, soil fertility and quantity, water quality and quantity, and the quality of the air are constant values, not variables, constant values. Therefore, the only variable we manipulate is how fast we grow the tree.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that isn't true. Soil fertility, water quality, air quality, and the quality of the sunlight that reaches the forest going through the polluted air are all variables. But we look at them as though they're linear and that they are constant values, and all of our economic models omit them, so they're assumed to be constants. All of the models are linear, and the forest is cyclic, so we have no idea of what we're doing over time. Now, this doesn't mean we can't have a sustainable forest. We can. It doesn't mean logging's bad. It isn't. It doesn't mean we can't have a good timber industry. We can. In fact, I will always argue for the timber industry, but on the basis of a biologically sustainable forest, not an economically sustained yield, because we can't have an economically sustained yield of anything until we first have a biologically sustainable forest. See, we're looking at the system backwards. We focus only on the products, not on the processes. It's like a box cake. If you take a box cake and dump it out, Even if it has a recipe in it, what have you dumped out? You've dumped out ingredients. Ingredients are only half the cake. The other half of the cake is the interactions among the ingredients that causes the cake to rise. So you've got to add water, eggs, so forth. Those are still ingredients. But if the processes that cause the cake to do what it does can't take place, like leave out the baking powder, and when the cake's done, you drop it on your foot and break your instep, you don't have the kind of cake you wanted because one ingredient and therefore its interaction was omitted. Now, that's what we're doing to the forest. We're leaving out half of it, the interactions between soil, water, air, and sunlight. That is what creates the forest. Well, we look at the forest and think it's only trees.
Yeah. Well, I tell you, I have a caller here I'd like to talk with. Let's do that. We'll go here to line number one. Hello.
Hi. I had a couple questions. The first had to do with the role of forest fire in a sustainable forest. I think it was Scientific American about 6 months ago had an article about the Yellowstone National Park forest fires, and the thesis there was that it was a very natural thing for, at that stage in the life of the forest, for there to be massive forest fires because there was so much dead growth that it was there's just a lot of kindling wood. It was very flammable, and the net result was that it cleared out area for new growth and left the soil fertilized by the ashes. The second question is related to what you're just talking, related to that. In a in the way that they're raising timber now, where they first of all started cutting the original growth, replanted, cut that down, and now I think they're in the second or in some places third growth that they have cut down. Without forest fires being a regular part of it, without also adding time, how has that affected the soil fertility?
Those are excellent questions. Let me write down your last one so I don't forget it.
So the lack of forest fire.
Got it. Okay, let's deal with the fire first.
Okay.
The thing that drives the world, that drives the universe, is what we call catastrophic disturbance. Fire is a catastrophic disturbance. It can kill a whole forest. Flood is a catastrophic disturbance. In Florida, hurricanes take the place of fire and blow the forest down rather than burn it up. So fire is a natural part of the system, particularly since the close of the last ice age as the world warmed up. Now, there are two kinds of fire that affect the forest. And one is the catastrophic fire. It's what we call a stand. A stand is a group of trees. Let's say that you have 1,000 acres. And let's just draw a line around and call that a stand. That's a portion of a forest. The stand replacement fire, or the forest replacement fire, is that fire which is so hot, what today would be called a wildfire, that it actually kills the forest. But it doesn't burn it up. It leaves a lot of the dead trees standing. Some of them fall over. And this is nature's reinvestment of the nutrient capital stored in those trees back into the soil, which is then manifested in the new forest. The other kind of fire is what's called the stand maintenance fire, or the forest maintenance fire. This is one that creeps around on the ground, and it burns at different intensities. It might flare up in a snag. It might kill a tree here or there. It'll burn up a few logs. What it does, basically, is it kills the underbrush, including the understory or shade-tolerant trees. Now, in the Northwest, that's hemlock and cedar. Douglas fir is not shade-tolerant. It's also dependent on fire in order to grow. Douglas fir is what we call a fire subclimax. And a climax is like the last stage in a play. Well, if there's some disturbance that prevents the play from ever getting to the climax scene, then you're always stopping one scene short. That's what fire does. So when the fire goes around on the ground, it cleans up a lot of the dead wood, and so you don't have these massive accumulations all over. It also kills the understory trees, like the hemlock and cedar, and this is critical, because if those trees are allowed to grow, and they will grow up till their green portion is in the green portion of the overstory or the big tree, 60 to 100 feet above the ground, you now have a ladder for the fire, the ground fires, to go all the way up into the crown. If they're burned out, you don't have that because you have two things operating. The first is Douglas fir has very thick bark, and it protects the wood from the fire up to about 60 feet. And the other thing is that these ground fires keep the ground clear of debris, and so the flames never get high enough to reach up into the live branches. So fire actually fireproofs the old-growth forest, the maintenance fire. What's happened when we eliminated fire is we have not only allowed the fuel to build up, but we have also allowed these understory shade-tolerant trees to grow tall enough to get into the crown of the big trees. Now we've set the West up to burn, and Yellowstone, in my opinion, was pablum. I don't think we've seen anything yet. But keep in mind in all of this that the greatest catastrophic disturbance has been the human being who disrupted all of nature's cycles that kept the forest healthy and changing. Yellowstone would not have been so bad if the Park Service had burned it, prescribed fire, as the ecologist told them to do a decade ago. I suspect many of our national parks are in trouble because of lack of fire. And they're either going to introduce fire back into the parks or we're going to lose more than Yellowstone. Okay, that's the first part. The second part is with the forest, if you plant a crop of trees and then cut them, plant and cut, plant and cut, first of all, what you do is use up the savings account of the nutrients in the soil. Fire does not necessarily replace nutrients. It volatilizes some of them, like nitrogen, with burning. But what fire does is it starts the forest over and allows the shrubs to come in, which are like crop rotation to a farmer. In the Northwest, for example, we have a shrub called Ceanothus, snowbush. And it's a special one, Ceanothus vegetinus. It comes in following fire, and it has little nodules on the roots that contain nitrogen-fixing bacteria. Now, that means the bacterium can go up into the atmosphere, take nitrogen out of it, and convert it to an ammonia product that the shrub can use, and a lot of that leaches into the soil. The other thing is there's a fungus growing on trees, which are an extension of the root system, which are absolutely necessary for the trees to survive. The trees feed the fungus sugars from their crowns, and the fungus goes out into the soil and picks up water, phosphorus, and nitrogen and moves it into the tree's root tip. The tree cannot get this itself. Well, it so happens that the Ceanothus, the snowbush, maintains in the soil some of the same fungi necessary for the Douglas fir forest when it comes back in. So what fire does periodically is start the forest over, creates a lot of habitat diversity, it prunes the forest, it thins the forest, it changes the forest, it prevents it from becoming a smorgasbord for insects, and it creates a lot of habitat diversity and how the trees rot when they've been killed by fire or stressed and so forth. All of this builds diversity into the system that putting it into a tree farm takes out. And so by eliminating the fire from the tree farm, you're eliminating even more of the diversity through time. And the other thing is, we don't know everything fire does that's beneficial. We only see the appearance of it's burning something up. But we tried to get money for years to study charred wood and find out what fire did to alter the chemistry of the wood that's left out in the forest and how it rots. But it wasn't a crisis, so we could never get the money to study it. It's still a question that needs to be answered. I am concerned if fire is ever removed from the ecosystem because it has played such a dynamic role in shaping the ecosystem to the way that we find it desirable. So it makes patently no sense to me to take out one of the main agents of change that has given us what we want. And we have no idea what removing it will do.
Does that get your question, caller?
Yes, I was just wondering also, though, what effect, just concretely, I think I've heard that the yield has been reducing now that it's in the third planting of cropped lumber in the Cascades, say. Has this noticeably been affecting the yield, and how much longer do you think that it will be able to be sustained or will be sustained by the big timber companies? Is this going to be something that will finally just deplete the soil to the point where nothing can grow very well?
That is, now you're getting closer to it. In Europe, they found that by the end of the second crop, they lost 30% of their yield. And if you look at the old forest, the one that was originally there that we cut and then put into a plantation, we removed from forest and put into plantation, what we're doing is living on the savings account that has been built up in the soil over the thousands of years that the forest has been cycling through the soil. We call this the old growthedness of the soil. In other words, the carryover component. If you cut the forest today, there's a lot of woody material left, and there's a lot of it already incorporating into the soil. That's stored available nutrients. But if you put in a crop of trees and you take out as much of the product as you can, and then you do this again and again, what you're doing is drawing down the soil nutrient account until you deplete the soil. And this has happened in China. It's happening in Europe. It's happening in the southeastern United States, and it's happening in the Northwest. Yes, you're absolutely correct. What we're doing is mining the soil of its nutrient capital. And this is not even good economics. And this is what I meant by reinvestment. What the question you asked is critical. In any business, including this radio station, part of the capital that's made, part of the money that's made, is reinvested in maintaining the equipment. But if you look at money as symbolic of the value we place on something else, you'll find we spend $0 on maintaining the health of the soil that grows the entire forest. So unless we maintain the health and the fertility of the soil on purpose, consciously, we can only draw down the account because we're taking more out than we're putting in. We're not balancing the accounts. And every business who operates that way goes bankrupt, and so will the forest. And that's our choice. We choose to value only the product and not the system. And that is a mistake humanity has made all over the world. We do not reinvest any biological capital in any renewable natural resource system that I know of.
Mr. Mazur is formerly a research scientist with the U.S. Department of the Interior Bureau of Land Management, and he is now a private consultant in sustainable forestry and also a museum research associate in zoology at the University of Washington in Seattle. He's written a number of scientific articles, most of them dealing with some aspect of forests, including a recent book entitled The Redesigned Forest, which is about the future of forestry and some of the issues that we've been talking about this morning. If you have questions, you can pick up the telephone and give us a call, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. That is our first number is our local line, and the other is our toll-free line, so that no matter where you're listening, you can use that number. Is it possible with the kind of demand that we have for wood products today, and also especially for paper, that we can satisfy the demand and yet not get to the point where we've destroyed all of the forest or depleted the soil through tree plantations to the point where we can't grow anything anymore?
That's an excellent question. Let me answer this in two ways. First of all, we can have a sustainable forest. I want people to understand that. Plantations are not evil. It's just that they cannot be continued in perpetuity in a straight line. Let's say that we grow a plantation two or three times and the tree growth begins, the yield begins to drop. Then we have to allow the area to leave it alone for maybe 200 years, 300 years to allow it to heal itself, to replenish the soil, and to fix the processes we have broken. Like a leg, if I break my leg, the doctor can put a pin in it and a cast on it, but he can't heal it. It only heals with time. The forest is the same way. So we can't have a sustainable forest, but now there comes the other part of the question, and that's need. The demand is a contrived thing. Humanity, particularly in Western civilization and capitalism, we have this weird notion of confusing need and desire. When we think we need something, what we're saying is we want something. That's why I always think of the catalogs that my wife and I are bombarded with that we never order as torture books, because you didn't have a thought in your head that you needed anything or wanted anything until you go through a catalog and, oh, my God, here's this sweater, and I've got to have it. Now I need it. That's a want, a desire. The question we need to ask is, what is the necessity for humanity to survive? That's very different from need. If we, in our purchasing, would be more conscious of the consequences we cause and how rapidly we are depleting the world of its resources, and ask the question, what is necessary for me to have to be comfortable? Not what do I want, but what is necessary, we'd be looking at the world very differently. I think there is still enough of the forest left, and I think we can heal enough of the forest to meet humanity's necessities. I think, however, if we stick with needs, we are already beyond the carrying capacity of the world's forests at the rate we're cutting them down.
Well, let's take another caller here. We have someone on our toll-free line. Hello.
Hello. I was wondering, recently they've been doing market surveys, and as I understand it, it shows that Americans are very, very concerned about the environment. But the follow-up is they are unwilling to change their lifestyle in any way, whether it's disposable diapers, the kind of car they drive, almost anything. So isn't it almost like President Bush is really the perfect president because he says, I'm very concerned, you know, this is terrible, and does absolutely nothing? What's your answer?
Your question is a fantastic one. It reminds me of Arnold Toynbee, the famous historian, because, ma'am, you put your finger right on the nose. I just finished writing a book about this very thing. Arnold Toynbee studied 26 civilizations that collapsed and asked a simple question, why did they collapse? And his answer was because they either wouldn't or couldn't change to meet the changing needs. And this is his concept has been corroborated by two people who used to work with the Soil Conservation Service. The discovery was that the civilizations collapsed when they used up the fertility of the topsoil. In other words, because they refused to change, they brought about their own demise. And I would suggest we're headed in precisely the same direction because we refuse to change. Now, understand, change is very frightening. A couple of weeks ago, our favorite dog died, a dog we love very much. And all of a sudden, that fast, within the click of a finger, our whole life was changed. And it was excruciating. But keep in mind that the Buddhists have learned that the only constant in the universe is change. And we must honor change. And what we do is try to kill it all the time. We have to change if we are going to survive. And that's a choice. Change is a choice. If we do not change how we purchase things, if we do not change our consciousness level, yes, we will outstrip the forests. We are killing the soil. I took part in a committee of Congress struggling with the 1985 Farm Bill. And one of the things that was a rude awakening for me is that soil erosion is no longer the number one problem in agriculture in the United States today. It's pollution of our groundwater. There are 142 chemicals in our groundwater just from fertilizers that weren't there before. But unless we change, we're going to poison the whole world. And the thing that's fascinating about this is the soil. One of the most humble things on earth, we walk on it every day, and we take it for granted. That is the stage in which the entire human drama is enacted. As we are killing the soil, we're killing ourselves. It's indirect suicide. Nuclear weapons, the bomb, is not the threat to the world. The bomb is the soil that we're killing daily because we refuse to change our thinking. Ma'am, your question was beautiful. Thank you.
Okay, now I have a question about, in Minnesota and Wisconsin, they've had pine wilt, and now I see it in Illinois. Are you familiar with that?
No.
Okay.
What's the name again?
It's referred to as pine wilt. The needles turn yellowish-orange, and then the whole tree goes.
Oh, this is something that they're pinning on air pollution-type death?
They didn't give a reason. It's just but it happens very quickly. I mean, a tree can go in, you know, a couple of weeks.
There are a lot of things that kill trees, and what we tend to do, and I don't know whether it's air pollution or not, or whether it's chemicals in the soil pollution, whatever. But let's look at that for just a second. There are lots of things killing trees in the world today, but nobody is looking at our management practices. Everyone's pointing the finger at air pollution. And my point is that we tend to exclude ourselves from taking any accountability for what is going on, and we can't do that. We are where we are today, collectively, by the individual choices that we as human beings make. We always have a choice. Choice equals hope. Hope and choice equal human dignity. As long as I am breathing, I have a choice, not of the circumstances, but how I react to the circumstances. Therefore, ultimately, I am responsible for my actions, and I must be accountable for them. Your question about your statement about change is correct. No one wants to be responsible or accountable for himself or herself, and we have to be. We can only change the world one person at a time because we cannot legislate values or feelings. They come from inside. We have to take the responsibility to change. And I believe in people. If we are each willing to be responsible, I think we can turn the world around.
Okay, and last question about Europe. You see references in the general press about Germany, and especially the pollution in East Germany, and just major problems. How bad is it, and where do you get your information?
It's very bad, and I get my information because I worked in Africa, I worked in Asia, and I lived in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And we also had a conference here not too long. In fact, my last trip to Europe was in 85, looking at forest problems. I correspond with Europeans, and we had a conference here in which some eminent European foresters came over, and they're absolutely shocked at what we're doing because they said, we learned over the last century it doesn't work. Why are you still doing it?
And, I mean, are there trees, like, there are no trees, or what is happening?
No,
like,
there are trees. The European story is a fairly complicated one. One, first thing is they cut out their forests years ago, over a century ago, for a whole number of reasons, war, the Industrial Revolution, etc. They had to try and heal a forest, rebuild one, and they made some mistakes. They weren't wrong. They weren't bad people. They weren't wrong in that they did the best they could, so there's no criticism or blame. I look at it as the world's longest experiment, and it didn't work, so now we need to look at doing it differently. And the more enlightened Germans particularly are, they are no longer clear-cutting the way they used to. Switzerland is illegal to plant monocultures. They're going back to managing with nature, as one German professor, and he was a past Forstmeister, said at Oregon State University late last year. They're going back to managing with nature. That the intensive management that they have been practicing has been killing the soil. And they have only have one place that he knows of, a pine forest, which is its natural site, that has grown for more than three rotations, three plantations. So they have caught on to something, but we don't want to change. It's like Thoreau said, luxuries is what everyone else buys. If everyone else will change their mind, then I don't have to, and I can stay within my comfort zone. That's our basic problem.
We just have about 5 minutes left, and I have a couple of other callers. I'd like to try and get at least one of them in. We may not be able to get both. So I hope that gets at the caller's questions, and I do want to move on here to somebody on line number one. Let's do that. Hello.
Hi. My question is about teak wood being used for furniture, in particular outdoor furniture. Now, I receive a large number of catalogs that offer this type of thing. Some of them say we don't offer teak wood because we don't believe in deforestation and we're concerned about the rainforest, etc. And others, you know, make a point of stating their stance, and I'm reading from one even, that they're concerned about the world's rainforest. That's why they only purchase teak furniture made of wood harvested from self-sustaining plantations in Indonesia. And then they go ahead to ask you to contribute to the Rainforest Alliance in New York. And I don't think I'm going to buy any. For one thing, it's very expensive. But every time I see this, I wonder, is this a responsible attitude? I know you've spoken of you know, plantations as mining the soil. And what do you think about this?
Ma'am, I think your intuition, what your heart is telling you, is correct. I don't know of any plantations that have proven over time, the long run, to be sustainable. And it's basically a contradiction in terms, because we know more in the United States probably and the Germans in Europe about forestry than any place else in the world, and we haven't been able to grow sustainable plantations. So I doubt seriously that anyone in Indonesia has. When we look at something, we call it sustainable. Keep in mind that crops of corn, you have a crop every year, but a forest may take 80 to 100 years for one crop. And as long as it exceeds our lifetime, we think of it as sustainable. And my point is, I will consider it sustainable when I've seen 10 crops in a row. And I won't see 10 crops in a row. No one in history has ever grown more than three. The Germans, as I said, there's one pine forest now in its fourth, but that's the only one I know of anywhere. And it appears to be sustainable, but the others patently haven't been. So I would suggest that Indonesian plantations are not sustainable. The other point is, and a very quick one, while we're all sending money down to protect the rainforest, we're cutting out the forests in the Pacific Northwest that actually have more living tissue per acre than the rainforests do. We're cutting out the biggest forests in the world with the biggest trees and the greatest amount of living tissue, but we're not looking in our backyard. We're criticizing everyone else, and I suggest there's some hypocrisy there also.
I want to squeeze in one more person here. We'll go to line number two. Hello, I'll have to ask you if you can to be brief, though.
Okay, real quickly.
Mm-hmm.
We've lived out here since 1971 in the country, in the middle of the agrochemical belt.
Where's here?
Near in Douglas County.
What state?
Illinois.
Okay, I'm in New Mexico.
I'm trying to be real brief.
Yeah, go ahead.
I've been working 19 or 20 years calling up the ag department every time the farmers come out here and spray a new chemical because we have shallow wells.
Mm-hmm.
The last episode was with a farmer spraying 40 acres around us with paraquat, mm-hmm. and I came out and stopped him, got the men off the tractor, and pleaded with them to stop because they didn't have any cover on their heads and the wind velocity was up above 20 miles an hour. I immediately called the agricultural department at the U of I, tried to talk to everyone in regards that were giving advice to the farmers at that time. I believe this was 5 years ago. They came out and met with me in the kitchen and they said, "Ma'am, don't you know that the chemical companies run this country? You're taking on a really big, you know, a big plan to take them on." And I said, I guess the culmination of it is the advice that these poor farmers get from their land-grant colleges is not always the best or foresightedness. And the three scientists that I talked to about paraquat, neither one of them could come to any conclusive evidence of how long it stays in the ground. So I'm totally confused if the ag departments in our land-grant universities, you know, are giving advice to the farmers. Is this going to change, or has it changed in relation to soil depletion and to water poisoning in our groundwater? Is there going to be any change in policy with the advice given to these farmers? Because I think they feel like they're up against the wall. Thank you, and I'll hang up.
Sure.
They are in many ways up against the wall because their lifestyle is changing also, and they don't have a choice in this anymore. You put your finger on the pulse of the issue here. From what I've seen in this country, the last bastions against change are the universities and Congress. I've worked as a scientist for 20 years, ma'am, and I wouldn't know a scientific truth if I stepped on one because I don't know a scientific lie. What we do know is that we are struggling to uncover things, but I would suggest that science and technology without a great deal of humility is dangerous, and that's exactly what you're talking about. When we approach these things as though we know something that reaches beyond our lifetime and we know what these things do in the soil, we are practicing one of the ultimate human arrogances. And what we're doing is passing on a terrible debt to the future. In California, Proposition 65 has forced the chemical companies to reevaluate and examine all of their chemicals, and they've come up with some nasty surprises. I would hope that what California has done goes nationwide. And if you'd like to know more about it, write to somebody in the legislature in California about 65, and they'll give you much better answers than I can. But they're finding some very nasty surprises in the chemicals the chemical companies are selling.
We're going to have to leave it at that because we're just about, actually, we're a little past our time. Chris, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. We appreciate it.
My pleasure. Have a wonderful day.
And again, for people who are interested in this topic, we have been talking in part about a book that our guest has written. His name is Chris Maser, and that's spelled M-A-S-E-R. It's published by Sierra Club Books. The book is called Forest Primeval.